With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi everyone, just before we start this week's show, just to let you know that halfway through this week's recording, we had a very slight issue with the recording quality of one of our guests. So the sound quality just changes slightly for just a few minutes and then it does come back. So hopefully you'll bear with us and enjoy the show. You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson. And not joining me this week is Ian Morris, but in his considerably sized shoes, it's CNET.com senior editor Andrew Hoyle.
Hello there.
Hey, Andrew, how are you doing?
Oh, it's great fun being inside these massive shoes of Ian's. I don't know why he needs them this size. I mean, what? This is the size of a house in the Peak District.
It raises the question of why he needs a shoehorn at all.
Yeah.
Well, yes, Ian is out of action, unfortunately, this week. So Andy's done us the great honour of joining us from what is essentially a weekend away. So thanks very much, Andy. We didn't want to go another week without a show. Last week we had our Japan special with my wife. I hope everyone who listened to that enjoyed it. Had some really great feedback on that. So thank you. And we'll hopefully be resuming our usual programming with Ian next week. But nonetheless, thank you to our patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/UKTech. If you're a patron, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. If you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free versions, which includes additional stories, live streaming usually, and access to our Discord members club amongst other things, head to patreon.com/UKTech to find out how you can support us with no commitment. We'd love you to give us a try, even just for a month. Now, we have to start with the elephant in the room here. A bit of a sad story. Everyone knows about this, but we can't not talk about it. Stephen Hawking, the British physicist and author of A Brief History of Time, amongst other incredible works, has passed away at the age of 76. This is a quote from his statement from his family. He says, "He was a great scientist and an extraordinary man whose work and legacy will live on for many years. His courage and persistence with his brilliance and humour inspired people across the world. He once said, it would not be much of a universe if it wasn't home to people you love. We'll miss him forever." Very sad news this, Andy. I mean, a long time coming in a sense. Doctors gave him a very short amount of time to live after he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease. And he sort of defied all the odds to live to the ripe old age of 76, where he died in Cambridge, according to his family. A great guy, Andy. Very inspirational. Absolutely. To me personally. What about you?
Yeah, very, very much so. As he is, I think, to everyone in the science and technology world, and I'm sure fields much further than that as well. He's done incredibly well considering the scale of his illness to reach the age that he has done, and achieve so many things along the way. I mean, I know that you met him personally. It was something I was hoping to do myself. Obviously, no longer possible. But I know that you count yourself in a very proud number of people who have been able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I met him a few years ago at the Royal Society. There was a presentation for something I was covering for Wired at the time. And Stephen was there. He was giving a brief talk at the time. And afterwards, when everyone was leaving, I got a chance to meet him. And it was one of those moments where I was genuinely speechless. It very rarely happens. I always seem to have something to say. But I have absolutely no... At the time, I remember having absolutely no idea what to say because I wasn't actually expecting to meet him. I just remember thanking him. It's the only thing that came into my head was to thank him because it was because of him. And, you know, when I was in my teens, I got very into science, almost went into studying astrophysics instead of becoming a journalist. And it was all because of him. And you know, I have many of his books. And I just remember saying thank you. And then I said something else, which I completely forgot. But whatever it was that I'd said, he replied with the word yes. So,
okay.
But it took about...
Was it, are you Stephen Hawking?
No, it wasn't. It was nothing as frivolous as that. Okay. But I'm sure whatever it was highly insightful. But he was in, he appeared in Futurama. He appeared in The Simpsons. He was a big fan of The Simpsons and Matt Groening's work. And I think those appearances really kind of underscored his great sense of humor, you know, despite dealing with an incredibly unfortunate illness. He sort of still managed to treat life with a great degree of humor and fun. And I think that in itself is inspirational, to be honest. I would love to think I could retain that level of humor and positivity if I was in a situation that he'd been in for so many years.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, inspirational.
Absolutely. Well, if anybody hasn't heard about this, I'm sorry to be the one to break the news to you, but there are, of course, some fantastic obituaries online. Wired did a fantastic one by João Medeiros. I highly recommend reading that. He is a friend of mine, obviously, from when I was at Wired, but he actually spent quite a great deal of time with Stephen over the years, particularly during one time when he was writing a feature about him as a cover story. So I definitely recommend that above others, but there are plenty. And if you have any memories of Stephen Hawking, any favorite works of his or any reasons why he inspired you, do let us know. We'd love to hear some examples for next week's show. hello@techpodcast.uk. Well, Andy, government plans to force adult websites to put up age verification barriers have been delayed following warnings that such a database could pose privacy and security risks. This is according to V3 this week. As part of the Digital Economy Act, the UK government is forcing commercial porn websites to have a robust age verification system to ensure that visitors are over the age of 18 before they can access any smut. And the new age checks were supposed to go live in April. But these concerns have been raised around the implementation of these checks and the risk that essentially such checks could involve third-party verification, and if the data was somehow compromised on behalf of adults, it could be extremely embarrassing to have, you know, a large database of adults who've been registered or had to prove their age somehow in order to access a very wide range of pornography sites. So the goal wasn't to do that as such. It wasn't to embarrass adults, but that's the risk. The goal was, of course, to safeguard kids and keep them away from pornography. And the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport has said that the checks will still be implemented later this year. So it's a pause. It's not a kill. Andy, I have to turn to you initially for your thoughts on age verification. But rather than answer my own question, which is something I often tend to do on this show, what are your views in general on age gates?
It's tricky because I am completely on the fence of the gates, as it were, in that I totally appreciate that they are important and that protecting children from seeing things that they simply shouldn't be seeing is important. What I don't know is how to do them, and clearly the ways that we've used so far, I remember old ways, I don't know if that's still a case, where simply putting in credit card details was itself the, even if it wasn't paid, was the age verification. Certainly anything that could potentially cause a security risk to adults, which is what they're discussing now, is definitely the wrong way around it when they're talking about using third-party services, third-party, you know, there'd be external servers where this information is being held, there'd be various bits of information about these adults using these services scattered who knows where on the internet, does not seem like a safe or a suitable option. That said, I don't know what is.
There's definitely been a precedent as well for these kind of leaks happening and the embarrassment that they can cause being made very, very apparent. I think the most notable example would be the Ashley Madison leaks a few years ago, you know, where it was for extramarital affairs. And there were many people who had their details released into the public as a result of a hack. And these are, you know, married individuals who almost certainly would not like their use of such a service to be put out into the public domain, even if there was some plausible deniability and they were not signing up to this site in order to have an extramarital affair, although I imagine those numbers are few and far between. It's just embarrassing to have to battle that. And I don't see any reason why that couldn't happen with pornography websites. And part of me wonders whether something like Ashley Madison leaks actually would be worse than a porn site, because I don't know. I get the impression that if you were married, in fact, I am married, and I said to my wife, she found out that I'd registered for a pornography site, I don't think she'd be anywhere near as bothered as if I registered for an extramarital affairs website.
No, of course. Those are very different things. And we live in an age where porn is commonplace, access to porn is commonplace, and discussion around those things no longer come with anything like the same level of sort of sniggering behind hands as it once did. And that's partly because it is just pretty much ubiquitous. Whether that's a good thing or not is not what I'm not discussing here. But certainly I think that having people's details being shown to be accessing porn as a whole concept is not necessarily embarrassing. Some people would find that embarrassing, but particularly some people with more niche interests or private interests that perhaps friends and family don't know about could be certainly extremely damaging. If these checks do take different websites into account, I don't know whether this is a one service where it is just, do you want the porn, yes or no, or is it a case of website by website access? Because I believe that there have been leaks on various gay porn websites that have inadvertently outed some of its users when they've been found to be accessing gay porn, when their friends, family, and in some cases even their spouses believe themselves to be straight. And those are very, very concerning issues where it is very much ruining lives. I would hazard a guess that for the most part, people just being having access to porn generally would not be ruining lives, but there may be people who write in and say, well, actually, no, if I found that, or if my wife found or my husband found that I was on porn, then it actually would be very damaging to their relationship. I don't know. But I think any measures that could potentially be leaked, that could potentially be exposed in this way, is not a safe option. But we live in an age where any information on the internet is potentially open like that. There are very few ways of handling these things that is completely foolproof. We've seen that with any services, from porn sites to extramarital affairs sites, banks, whatever. Anything can have these leaks, and they do. And that's something that we need to be constantly aware of.
And I do wonder whether there's a little bit of a double standard when it comes to pornography versus, say, video games. Because at the moment, and for many years now, video games have had to have age gates where you just have to put in your date of birth in order to access a website. And this is to prevent underage, younger people who are too young to play the game in question. You know, if the games are sort of for 16-year-olds, it's to prevent you from seeing that when you're 13. But we're talking, you know, any child wishing to view that material can very easily just say they were born in 1970. Goodness knows, yeah. I always used to back in the day. And can get immediate access to, you know, extremely violent videos of chainsaws through the face and all kinds of unpleasantness, yeah, that is rife in video games.
Of course, those checks, they protect the website, not the viewer. They're there to say to the website, well, they said they were old enough. That's not our fault. So that's only there for their benefit, but it doesn't protect the person from viewing it.
No. And it does make you wonder whether the knock-on effect would be adults are too afraid to register themselves as being old enough to view material. And in a way, you know, pornography isn't illegal. And there's nothing inherently, you know, there's nothing wrong in that sense in an adult wanting to view pornography. But if you to give it a taboo sense around it, like with an age gate and you have to prove it, like that would put a lot of people off. And I don't think that's great. I don't think that's good.
No.
Well, if you have any thoughts on pornography age gates and what could be a good way of implementing them, do let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. And if you actually know of any countries that have implemented these successfully and would like to give us some examples for us to pass on to the government and pass off as our own ideas, they're also very welcome at hello@techpodcast.uk. Well, just as I was flying off to Japan, Mobile World Congress was happening in Barcelona. Andy was there with the CNET force. We did talk about a couple of the sort of top line announcements from the show before we went away, the Samsung Galaxy S9 and also the new banana phone from Nokia. So we're going to put those to one side and pick out a couple of other things that Andy had highlighted that might be worth us talking about that may have slipped under the radar a little bit, but we wanted to expose for the intrigue that they hold within. The first is this Vivo concept phone. Now, this is an audio only podcast, Andy, so you're going to have to describe this to us. What is the Vivo concept phone and why are we talking about it?
Well, it's a phone. So first and foremost, it's a rectangle. But this one is particularly cool because they have, in order to make the screen completely dominate the front of the phone, like there is a wafer thin bezel on pretty much every edge, they've done some pretty cool things. So for one of the things that on like the iPhone X with Apple's notch, that notch is there for the front facing camera. That is instead built physically into the top edge of the phone. When you want to take a selfie, this camera sort of slowly slides out of the top of the phone, which looks really kind of neat. Whether it's any better or not, I don't know, but it's kind of a cool thing. Now, the other thing as well is that the screen itself becomes a speaker, both for phone calls and for loudspeaker. And it seems to do both really, really well. When you literally listen to someone talking on the phone, you wouldn't know that it isn't just a regular speaker in the top like normal. And similarly, when you want a loudspeaker, this thing is loud. The whole screen effectively vibrates with it, although you wouldn't feel it. You can't, it doesn't rumble across the table. I'm not quite sure how they do it, but it does seem to work really well. The third cool thing is that there are fingerprint scanners built into the display itself. So rather than having to have like a home button at the bottom or use Face ID or anything like that, the fingerprint scanner is built into the screen. But it also supports two fingerprints at once. So if you want to double the security, you have not one, but two fingerprints that you need to press down on the front to access the phone. So it just looks really cool. This is just seems like the sort of thing where they're taking this sort of concept tech, in-screen fingerprint scanning. The camera thing's a little bit weird, and to be honest, it looks like the first thing that will break on that phone, first time you leave the phone with the camera up and it just gets snapped off. But it's just doing something a little bit different, particularly at a period of time where, yes, smartphones are really powerful, but they're all pretty much the same. But this looks a little bit different, and it's just a bit quirky, and we'll probably never see it on sale, but it's just a bit of fun.
Well, apparently it is going to be on sale, and that was the reason that I thought it would be worth talking about, is that there were reports that they're going to put this into production later this year, which would suggest an availability next year. And we've seen that from many manufacturers time and time again, but, you know, it's
whether we see it on sale in its exact iteration as we saw it, or it could be that they take some of those things. I really don't know. I actually wouldn't want to buy a phone that has that camera that slides up like that. It just looks like a liability. It really does. I wouldn't trust it. I think that there's a different compromise to be made there.
Yeah, and the model is called the Apex, and the company is called Vivo, which is a Chinese manufacturer that I'd never heard of before now. And yeah, it could well be that this is one of those designs where another manufacturer sees it and, rather reversing the tables on what China often does best, actually copy them and take this as a bit of an inspiration of how to do this. I agree with the pop-up selfie. That's going to be the first thing that breaks, because phones like this that have moving parts, it's never a recipe for complete bulletproof functionality, is it? There's always...
No, it's not. I suspect it means they'll have to do away with things like waterproofing and certainly any dust that gets inside there. I mean, Christ, I've had to get tiny little pins to get dust out of the charging port on my iPhone so that the cable can go in properly. You try doing that on a slidey-up camera unit. I just would not trust it. And the price this is surely going to be, because this is cutting-edge technology that isn't inside any other phone. It's almost certainly going to come with a pretty fair premium, even given Vivo's usual sort of cut price area. I think this would be certainly on the much more expensive side of things. Whether you want to invest that sort of money with something that could potentially be a little bit flimsy, that's up to you, I suppose, but for my money, I'd go with something a little bit more robust.
Well, speaking of robustness, the other device that I wanted to flag is the Cat S61, which sadly is not a feline animal, but on the other hand, is a phone with a thermal imaging camera on the inside. Now, Andy, we knew about this phone, I think, maybe back in February or a little earlier in the year, but you seem to have managed to take one around MWC and take photographs with this in thermal mode. Can you explain who's this product for and how does this thermal imaging work?
Well, first of all, this isn't the first thermal imaging phone. The Cat S60 that they launched at MWC last year is the first one that had the tech in at all. It's actually provided by a company called FLIR, who make thermal imaging for professionals. But they also do a unit that clips onto an iPhone if you want to give your iPhone some thermal imaging skills, which is kind of neat. But this phone is for builders, plumbers, it's for the tradesmen. So one of the best examples you can really imagine with this phone is if you're a plumber and you're maybe installing networks of pipes in a building or you're checking them, and there's a blockage somewhere. This allows you to fire up the thermal and actually have a look at sort of the water flow of pipes around, and you can get a very, very good look of where the heat is or where the cold is, to be able to see where those blockages are. And that's normally something that previously you'd need pretty high-end thermal imaging equipment in, but having it in something that any plumber could have as his main phone or her main phone in the back of their pocket is, I think, makes it a very, very useful tool. But yeah, of course, as far as like us, the general consumers, are concerned, this is just a really cool opportunity to go around and see everyday objects and see the heat map they give off.
Yeah, so, I think my favorite example of this has got to be the coffee. So Andy took a picture of a latte in his gallery here. And it's interesting just to see the kind of how the heat dissipates through the cup into the saucer and whereabouts in the cup the water appears to be hottest. It's a very interesting sight. Also, by the looks of it, took some photographs of some dogs.
There was a dog I found as well. I made a point of finding a dog. But what I find interesting as well is because I had two Galaxy S9s, which I was testing, and I put them both face down on the table for about 5 minutes, and then I carefully put one of them to run the Geekbench 4 benchmark test, which is obviously very, very processor intensive. So I got to take this photo side by side of one phone, which looks very cold, and one which is sort of glowing yellow with a lot more heat. It's just purely because one of them is actually doing something. So it's really cool to see sort of a difference in heat when they're actually in sort of high demand use like that. But you can, I used my finger to sort of write on a bit of wall by sort of rubbing the faint outline of the CNET logo, and then took a photo in thermal. To the naked eye, that's just completely standard wall. There's nothing there at all. But in thermal mode, you see the heat trace left behind of where I'd made my drawing, which is fun. I may have also drawn something rude, but I didn't include that in my gallery.
I see. Well, we'll include a link to this gallery in the show notes. If you go to techpodcast.uk, look for episode 129, or if you're in a more capable podcast listening device, you should find the link in the embedded show notes there. It's definitely worth having a look at some of these. It's picture 4 in this gallery that's got the two Samsung Galaxy phones Andy mentioned, and picture, I think, 8 or 9, maybe not too much further, is the picture of the latte. All well worth looking at over there at cnet.com. Well, owners of Amazon's own brand power bank chargers. Now, this is a category of people that rarely get airtime on text message, but here's your lucky day, because you lovely people have unfortunately had to be contacted by the firm and been told to stop using them. This is according to the BBC this week. That's because Amazon has recalled 6 models of its Amazon Basics branded product. This was announced in the US and Canada, but the BBC says it also applies to the UK and some European countries as well. So it's worth everyone checking if you've got an Amazon Basics branded mobile power battery pack. That's because a notice posted on the US Consumer Product Safety Commission's website warns that the packs could overheat and ignite, posing fire and burn hazards. Amazon apparently has had about 50 complaints and one report of a user suffering chemical burns after coming in contact with battery acid.
Now, oh, good.
No, not good. And Amazon has done the right thing in recalling this. And we should point out that everyone who's worried should check. There's a link on our website in the show notes, or at and the BBC story that we linked to that allows you to check whether you've got an affected model. But the bad news with batteries just keeps coming. I mean, on the one hand, we've got people talking about how battery-powered cars and electric vehicles are the next big thing and that everyone should be excited about and moving on to. And on the other hand, we've got, you know, Samsung Galaxy Note 7s exploding on planes and you know, battery packs leaking battery acid onto their owners. This doesn't bode well for batteries, does it, Pand?
It doesn't, really, no. I think, but if... the problem is that what we found so far is that companies are trying to fast charge their batteries too quickly. That was a big issue with the Note 7, is they're trying to put too much power too quickly into them and without having the same rigorous safety checks. And that is potentially concerning when you're talking about electric cars, because obviously one of the big issues of electric car ownership is the amount of time it takes to recharge. Obviously, if you want to refill your car with petrol, it takes maybe a minute with a nozzle straight into the car. But for an electric car, certainly a large one, if you're not on a dedicated supercharger, it could take many hours. And so there's a lot of demand there for extremely fast charging. And when you're talking about batteries that size, potentially bursting into flames when you're cocooned within them, yes, is a very worrying thought. So there does need to be a lot of care and attention given to these things, which is already happening, of course. That is hopefully even more risk assessment is going on, because the company that this happens to, the first car that bursts into flame purely because of battery overheating and kills a passenger, is going to have a very, very terrible PR time. So the hope is that they will not want that to happen, and that these checks are going to take place. But we are just having more and more stories of these things happening, and there does seem to be different reasons behind the fires, behind the risks, for each one. So it's difficult to know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I asked the question about whether this is essentially whether this makes batteries as a concept less attractive to be used. But I really don't think we should be fearing them, because number one, these sorts of defects are extremely rare. I mean, I think the CPSC that reported this flaw in the US said something like about 250,000 of these units had been sold in the US alone, but Amazon had received 50 complaints of problems. And in terms of, you know, pure percentages, that is such a fraction of 1% that it's almost not worth commenting on at all. But obviously, when one person gets chemical burns, it's going to hit the papers and it's going to rightly justify a recall.
But absolutely, that's if it's a case of a defect. But I believe with the Note 7 issue, the argument was that it was actually it was a design flaw, like the way that the battery was not given any room to breathe, basically as it fast charges, which could cause a pressurization and therefore the explosion. There were differing reports around that, but certainly I think it was not necessarily that it was an individual defect, but a more widespread flaw with the design, hence the full recall of that entire series.
Yeah. Maybe you could tell us what people should do if their battery appears to be, exploding.
Well, if it's currently in the act of exploding, then that's different altogether. But if you suspect that it's getting overly hot, if you have any other problems, or certainly if you smell anything around it that could suggest maybe something internal funk is going on, immediately unplug it from the power source, or if you're using it to like an external battery to recharge your phone, unplug it from your phone, take out any wires, and put it somewhere non-flammable, ideally maybe outside. Do not throw it into a bucket of water, but just sort of remove it from anywhere where it could cause a problem. But the main thing to do is, of course, removing the power source from it, because that will be what is causing that issue.
Yeah, good advice. And there's plenty of advice online if you Google what to do when a battery explodes. I just did it, and there's quite a few answers. But if you've got an inventive one, let us know that as well. hello@techpodcast.uk. Well, let's just jump quickly into the mailbag. Before I went to Japan, we did discuss how the spires of English churches were being used to help extend broadband coverage in rural areas. And I asked how else churches around the world might have been embracing technology. Jacob wrote in as one of our regular listeners and patrons to explain how his parish in the US is adopting tech, which is really interesting. And I've cut down the email a little bit because it was quite long. But Jacob says, the primary way that we use tech in my setting is streaming our entire service on Facebook Live. We have three or four folks who use it regularly because they're homebound or otherwise unable to attend now. We've also had a few folks who have used it on occasions when they've been out of town. One member had a meeting out of state and was overjoyed that he was able to watch his children in the Christmas play while waiting for a flight in an airport. Facebook Live initially began as a mobile-only venture, so we had used my phone since we began, but I've been pushing for us to switch to a computer with a mounted camera so we can take advantage of our sound system. The quality for the phone is certainly passable, but it's nowhere near the audio or video quality that it could have with a more permanent setup. We've also started to experiment with some targeted advertising on Facebook. They provided us with $30 of credit to try it out, and we saw a significant improvement over our organic impressions. We've only just begun, so it's difficult to say what sort of an impact this might have, or if it will translate to new folks joining us. This is something we'll continue to experiment with. And then Jacob included three examples here of things that he's learnt so far, in case anyone else is looking to try something similar. He says, one, we had to update our music licensing to cover live streaming. Most of our music is public domain or covered by a standard license, but our choir and paid musicians typically use new-ish music that we were told we could be potentially liable for litigation without the appropriate license. He also says, it can be surprising where you find an audience. What surprised me most is that we have several folks who watch our service from Costa Rica. There are two explanations for this. We may well have actual people in Costa Rica watching our service, or we could have a clever parishioner who routes their traffic through a VPN using a Costa Rican IP address. He also said that for now, live streaming works best over mobile instead of Wi-Fi, but he reckons with a hardwired connection, that'll probably be more stable in the long run. Really interesting stuff. You know, I'm not a churchgoer, and neither is Andy, but I'm speaking on his behalf. I know this because he's my brother. But I am fascinated by all the ways that, you know, such a very old and very traditional, I want to say community, but I mean the church in general, how it's adopting new technology and adapting to modern opportunities.
Absolutely. So some of those things as well that that were mentioned sound similar to the things that I know you've talked extensively about on the show with sort of the 21st century classroom, in ways that people need to come together to learn and discuss, whether that's maths, English and science or the word of Jesus Christ. But the concept is the same. People need to come together so that technology is helping sort of both groups of people in very similar ways.
Yeah, and we've had some great discussions about that around the importance of people being present in a classroom as opposed to just distance learning and learning via video conference and Skype and things like that. So I agree. Well, thanks very much, Jacob, for writing in with such a interesting response to the question. Let's check in with another American, our good friend Tom Merritt over at Daily Tech News Show. Tom, what's been going on in the wide world of tech this week?
This week on Daily Tech News Show, we follow the saga of Broadcom, Qualcomm, briefly Intel, and then the U.S. government ends the whole thing. Talk about why IKEA is beginning assembly service in the U.S. Discuss YouTube's moderation policies. Talk about whether a decentralized web, aka Web 3.0, is on the horizon. And decide if we want our brains preserved for later upload, especially since they have to kill you to do it. All that and much, much more living stuff at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom. Andy, this is your point. This is your moment. You've been waiting for this for the last half an hour. Tell everyone where they can find you online. What should they be looking out for from you this week?
Oh, so exciting. Well, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram with @BatteryHQ. And of course, keep your eye on CNET.com for the tech news that we do. I've got a few really cool things coming up. Last week, I spent 4 days driving a very nice McLaren supercar back through the Swiss Alps with a Galaxy S9 Plus in my hand to do a side-by-side road test. That's turning into one hell of a feature, actually. So it's taking a little bit of time to get up. But do keep your eye on probably my social channels if you're at all interested in superphones or supercars or both.
I do hope you put the phone down while you were driving that McLaren.
I can say with all honesty that I was I obeyed all the laws about driving and using phones, which made things extremely difficult when I had to set up a phone on a tripod in the car when I'm pulled over in a lay-by, set it recording, and then drive for about 40 minutes until I get to the next lay-by, which means that I've got lots and lots of extremely long video files where I may only want about 6 seconds from each, or a little bit of sort of speaking to camera that I might want to use. But trying to actually dig that out of these huge files is proving so far to be a horrible, horrible task.
I think that's it, Andy. Thanks very much for joining us. And thank you, everyone, for listening and for supporting us at patreon.com/UKTech. Hopefully we'll have Ian back in his usual nest next week. And until then, we will continue to exist, as will hopefully you all. Toodlepip.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.